Very exciting news is I'm working with a friend of mine who runs, she runs a nonprofit that's doing mindfulness programs in 10 grade schools, 4 through 6. So we're talking with somebody to fund a program like this in 8 to 10 high schools next year. So if that happens, we're going to meet about this between now and Christmas, then the program here is going to be the model program. So that is pretty exciting. And you may get asked by the next year's kids to talk about your experience. So I'm really happy about that. So that's really good. And today we are going to do, which I keep promising or threatening, we're going to do the history lesson of how we got to be so stressed. So we're going to do a lot of meditation. We're also going to look at what was happening 500 years ago and what's happening now. So we are going to do another class, which is going to look at age, causes of stress, and also postmodern causes of stress and technology. But we're going to look at the last 500 years. Now, this is something that's very innovative. The classical mindfulness programs haven't talked about this that much, and it's a big missing piece in people's understanding of what's happening right now. So you're getting it at the beginning. So better, my meditation does do better without books. And I think we'll do is we'll follow the sound a couple times, and the third time we'll go straight into a 10-minute meditation. And I know I heard some people are feeling sleep deprived. This is a good refresher. It really does. It does help refresh your nervous system. So, and they've been doing research on it that short meditations are as good as certain amounts of sleep when you're not caught up on sleep. So definitely, if you're feeling tired, this is going to help you. Then we can start.
Did you see that article in the New York Times this week about massage therapy?
I didn't, no.
I'll send you the link.
Yeah.
And there's some connection there to
Mm-hmm.
the restorative value of massage the same way
Yep.
in lieu of sleep. That's good. Well, it's good this is happening now.
Right, it's happening before the holidays,
Right.
before finals or midterms. Okay, that's fine. All right, so let's focus and follow the sound and just relax and let the sound take you in. You don't have to worry about trying to still your thoughts. And when you can't hear it, raise your hand. This time, really track the sound of the bell. There's a lot of other noises happening. And this last time, let the sound take you straight into a meditation. We'll meditate for 10 minutes. Be as still as possible. See if you can feel a pull, an inner pull towards stillness, even if your mind or body is agitated. If you're experiencing a pull towards stillness, let your attention be soft and just be aware. Pay attention to the qualities. If you're feeling distracted, if it's hard to focus or be still, put your attention on the breath and the inhalation and the exhalation. Experience how the more still you become, the more sensitive your capacities for awareness become, the more you notice, but the less disturbed you are by various noises and distractions, sensations and thoughts. If you feel like you want to be distracted, bring your attention back. Try to pay attention to everything and nothing specifically. Practice being at ease and softening your awareness while at the same time being more alert. You may start to feel unexpected itches or twitches. Keep your body still, your attention relaxed, but imagine that you're opening your inner eyes and ears of perception. Take one last look. See if you can become sensitive to any different feelings or moods that have arisen or that you became aware of. Unexpected joy, the presence of tension. To see what's there, and then let the sound bring you out of the meditation. That was good timing. Your ears started itching. I noticed, you know, what happened was somebody started scratching. and it sort of traveled around the room. It's like yawning. In meditation, it starts to become contagious. You know, it's cold in here a little bit. There are two more at the door. Hi, why don't you take one of these two here? Great. All right. So, hi. Before we get into the why we're so stressed, the thing about meditation is it does help you practice awareness, and it helps you become aware of what is without touching it, without being affected by it. And it's called detachment, but detachment doesn't mean that what cultivating the art of detachment does is it helps us be more in control of what we're responding to and what we're not. It doesn't mean that if you see things or respond to things, you know, see things that need a response, that you don't respond. But you're choosing how and when and with what level of self-awareness you're responding to. Now, this can be really challenging, and oftentimes you're going to be in a situation where you don't know whether what you're responding to is correct or not. Mindfulness is going to help you be able to be a better judge of that. And sometimes you need to let go of what you want to respond to, and sometimes you really need to react to what you're responding to. I was in a meditation retreat. This happened to be in Northern Massachusetts with a very famous meditation teacher who just passed away. He was in his late 80s, and he was one of the main Buddhist meditation teachers all over India and the States. His name was S.N. Goenka. And he was into this very austere meditation technique. So when you go, it was just breath meditation and body scan meditation. And when you go in, he made you, you know, if you had any ritual objects or religious objects or sentimental objects, you had to check them in before you go on this retreat. And this was like a meditation camp. And I was very sensitive because I just finished a 200-hour yoga teacher training. So I was, you know, pretty settled. You know, it was summertime. It was gorgeous. And I got there and we're all in these big tents with like 25 people. And then I think there were 250 people there on the meditation retreat. And after the third day, he's very, very strict, you know, and he was big, you know, and you just do your body scan. You do exactly what he says. And you don't do anything else. And they're very, very rigid. It's a little bit like the military camp of mindfulness meditation. But on the Bodin page, I put up two documentaries of programs by some of his senior teachers that were done in one in an Indian prison and one in an Alabama prison that are pretty, they're powerful documentaries. They're outrageous. But anyway, I was there and I was sick. I was really sick. And I was on my bed in one of the breaks, and I was kind of making noise because I was really sick, and I had this raging fever, and my bones were like, you know, when you have fever in your bones hurt. But my fever was about 104 and rising. I was really sick, and so some of the people complained about me because I was making noise, and you're not allowed to make any noise. And so one of the senior teachers came and said, look, you're not allowed to make any noise. I said, I think I have malaria. And when I was in India, I had malaria, and I thought this was a recurrence of malaria, which is, it's really unpleasant. It's terrible. And she said, no, we've seen so many things on meditation retreats. You start meditating, you'll start experiencing all kinds of sensations going up and down your body, and you know, they're going on. And I said, no, I have malaria. She said, no, we've seen this, we've been doing this for a really long time. I said, no, I think I have malaria. So she went and got another assistant teacher who'd been doing this for about 30 years, and he happened to be a doctor. So they, I was, because I told them I really thought I was sick. So they took a blood test. It was near UMass Medical Center. So they sent it over to UMass Medical Center. And sure enough, I did have malaria. And they moved me out of the tent and into the house. And I sort of, I vaguely remember, you know, after, you know, I got the medication, kind of paying attention to a little bit of the talks at the end. But these are times when sometimes you actually do have to respectfully push against authority. And you're not always right. In this case, I definitely was, and it would have been a bad thing if I had not responded to it. So meditation does make you aware, and I was aware of the delicacy of the retreat, and they don't want people interrupting it. They have 250 people. They've been doing it for 50 years. They know what they're doing. And meditation, all kinds of things can happen. I've seen people have all kinds of experiences and illnesses and stuff, so I understand that. And at the same time, there are real life parasites and spores and problems that you can get, especially if you travel to Asia or Africa. Yes. What's that?
Is it a virus?
I don't know if it's a virus. It comes from mosquitoes, and there's I thought it was bacterial because they can treat it. And so when they bite you, they're like mushrooms. They leave little spores in your bloodstream, and then these little spores can hatch periodically.
They're not parasites.
They're some kind of I don't know. It's some kind of spore thing. I don't know exactly, but you used to, you know, oftentimes when you read when you were younger, if you ever read those sea stories that, like, they're always Gilligan's Island, they're always going to these far out places and getting malaria. But you get it from mosquitoes, and it's very uncommon in America, and the Bill Gates Foundation has done a great job of eradicating it in Africa, which is a really good thing, because it usually kills a high proportion of especially children and old people who get it. So anyway, that's my story about mindfulness and learning to be aware, but learning that detachment just makes you more objective, more able to discern, more able to separate emotionality from fact or from, you know, some type of human relationship and relatedness that needs your response. And that's a big part of what we're cultivating. So back to the topic of the day. Why we're so stressed. So if we look back the difference between 500 years ago, 600 years ago, so sort of 1500.
Oh.
Yes.
The Great Depression.
The Great Depression happened. That was that. But in 1500, we're looking at sort of the middle and towards the end of the Renaissance in Europe. So what I want to look at what changes happened in the political world, in the scientific world, and also in the religious world that might put more stress on the individual. Does anyone have any ideas? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also that new technology brought upon more questions to religious beliefs, and that was also a big shift up in that whole time period, becoming, you know, the disbelief inside what the church says and or what your religion says.
Very good. That's excellent.
Can you repeat a little bit what was said for us?
You want to say it louder?
Technology, new questions were brought upon that churches and other religions couldn't really fully answer, and that brought upon, I guess, disagreements with religious or religious beliefs and stuff.
Great. Yes.
For what he said, the alignment area, that was like the area where they was deciding to move away from listening to what all the authorities said and creating their own rules.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they was kind of stressed because they wanted to decide whether they should follow the enlightenment period or whether to just stick by a guidance in the world.
Exactly. That's very good. What were you going to say?
Well, before that, before the enlightenment period in the 1500s, there was a strict ordinance in Catholicism that was either like, you do this, or you'll go straight to hell. And that people were, a lot of people were worried that, oh, if I don't go to church, or, oh, if I don't do this the exact way the priest said that I should, I will go to hell. And that caused a lot of stress because there were so many things that had to be done to the T. And I guess that's stressful.
Well, interesting. That's true. What's interesting, though, is looking at it a little bit in the opposite way, is that when the church told you what to do, because we're looking at, well, what were the big changes then that put more pressure on us as individuals now? Because there was a great sea change around this time. And like you said, the church told you exactly what to do. So the Catholic Church, which predominated across Europe, told everyone exactly what to do to the T, as you said, and you didn't have to think about it. So you just had to obey. You didn't have to decide whether you agreed with it or you didn't agree with it. You just simply had to do exactly what you were supposed to do. And since everybody did that, you didn't have to think about what that was. Everyone sort of self-imposed that on the culture. Now, if you have to decide for yourself, so Martin Luther came and he said, you know, well, we're going to have the Protestant Reformation and we don't need any intermediaries for God, and there can be more diversity in how we live our lives. So that led to a certain thing. And now what we see now is that we have, in the postmodern era, there's a lot of religious diversity. But within that, individuals have to choose what they believe in, how they're going to practice it, to what degree, how much they're going to balance science and how much they're going to look to the scientific world for any kind of moral code. Are they going to look to mystical texts, religious texts? So there's pressure on the individual. There's no, the church, and I use the term church broadly, you know, for any of the traditions, provided a sense of how to live. All of a sudden, the individuals have to figure out how to live. And you can see in Japanese culture versus American culture, in our culture, there's a lot more insecurity. Japanese youth have their own pressures because they're forced to conform, but there isn't the same level of insecurity. Youth culture in America is filled with the sense of, I'm not sure what to do, I'm not sure how to do it, I'm not sure what I believe, I'm not sure what's right, I'm not sure if there's anything deeper, and I don't know how to figure it out. So that's a huge difference from when you knew exactly what to do. And if you didn't do it, you knew exactly what was going to happen to you. It wasn't going to be good, but you knew what was going to happen to you. So you can see that part of our culture now, which was, it was a positive development, it was a cultural evolution, it was a real step towards self-authentication and individuation. It led to a lot of creativity. But it left us without much to hold on to. And that's created, it's been internalized, and it's created a real sense of unsurety that's hard to deal with because you think it's your problem. You know, I don't know what to do. I'm going to look on YouTube for some self-help, something that's going to tell me how to do this, that, or the other. But it's much deeper than that. It's much more systemic than that. Yeah. What's that?
The word
what it?
Systemic.
Systemic. It means it's a system. It's not like your fault that you're confused. It's not my fault that I don't know what to do. It has to do with the whole system, that we don't have stable structures.
Systemic.
Yeah. It's a good word because we used to think in terms of occurrences, in terms of sort of objects and facts, and a lot more of the way cultural development and also scientific innovation is looking at more at systems, how things interplay with each other in the movement. And that's also a change in postmodernity. We didn't used to look at things that way. The scientific revolution looked at things more in terms of objects affecting other objects, not a system. Buckminster Fuller, who was a great systems theorist, lived in Philadelphia for much of his most productive time. He lived in Society Hill Towers, actually.
Really?
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah. A lot of great people from Philadelphia, believe it or not. So this is, you can also see in politics, we had the same situation as we did with religion, is that it used to be primarily monarchies, that the rule of law was descended through a bloodline. You knew who was going to rule, or roughly who was going to rule, and within those ruling classes, one was going to marry another, and it was a small subset of people who were going to take over the throne. And everyone else had to follow the royal decree. So when parliaments and democracies started to take hold across Europe, that was a very good thing. And then you can see in America, you know, with the establishment of this country and the establishment of democratic rule and the insistence that there would be no dynasty, that one of the things the Founding Fathers had to contend with was the fact, and they spoke about this and they wrote about this in some of their private letters, is that most of the population here in the early days was not particularly educated. They didn't care that much. They were just struggling to make it all work. You know, they just got here. There wasn't much here. And they said, how can we have a democratic rule if individuals aren't educated enough to take responsibility for it? So they created the system that they did, which now is not working very well, which is another reason why we feel stressed.
We are studying the Crucible right now, which takes place in 1692.
Yeah.
So just so you know what we're doing when you're not here.
Yes.
So we're kind of right at that time in history you're starting to talk about.
It's a very exciting time because you could see that there was something happening in the cultural zeitgeist in Western Europe and in the early Americas that was creating this sense of individuality and the sense that we can think for ourselves, we can govern for ourselves, we can create rights for everyone. I mean, William Penn wanted to have equal rights between the genders in the mid-1600s. That was unheard of. He was not in favor of slavery. He was in favor of the equality between all races. I mean, that was unheard of in the 1600s. And you can see that the average mindset was way below that. So democracy was an innovation, but it put pressure on the individual, and it means that the individual had to think for themselves. So you have to figure out, what do you think? What do you think is going to happen? All of a sudden, you have to start thinking about, well, what is going to be the economic repercussions if we go this way or versus that way? I believe in this, but what are going to be the effects of that policy? How do I work all that? How do I make a decision about who knows what they're talking about? How do I decide who's telling the truth? So democracy is a great thing, but to make it work, you need a population that's going to participate. And to participate, you have to assume a level of responsibility and burden that you didn't if it was a monarchy. If you were, you know, some kind of, you know, serf in, you know, feudal Germany, you didn't have to think about anything. You just had to make sure that you paid your landlord, you know, his disproportionate share of your produce, and he'd leave you alone, hopefully. But you didn't have this burden of choice. And that's partly why, again, we as postmodern individuals now, we don't see it. I mean, we were born into democracy. We don't really feel it. But there is a level of individual stress and frustration that is hard to contend with. And part of it is also there's a sense that an individual's forced to choose and decide, but doesn't necessarily have the power to do anything significant. And that puts the individual in a bind. And so the level of stress that we feel now is very much related to these things. With the scientific revolution, you saw that also, because what happened during the scientific revolution was they saw that we could change the principles and laws that were thought to be immutable through the power of observation. So Copernicus and Galileo conducted experiments. They looked at things with very primitive devices, but it was mainly through the power of observation that they overturned the idea that the sun revolved around the earth, that the earth was the center of our universe, and also that before then, from the time of Ptolemy, they thought that the universe was unchangeable. It was immutable. And Galileo saw a supernova explode with one of his primitive telescopes. He said, oh my God, these stars, they die. They're born and they die, just like everything else. Now that to us is, you know, we see them. We can, you know, we can go on the web and we can watch some of these supernovas, and it's far out, but we accept it as a fact. Now during the 1500s, it was a huge upheaval that what everyone thought was solid, the stars were eternal, were not eternal. So we're living with this sense of system, of process, of movement, and that creates a lot of possibility, but it creates a sense of overwhelm. And it can create a sense of sort of existential fear that you can't place. It's like, why do I feel so anxious? Because we don't know what to hold on to. And we don't know how to relate to process and system and cause and effect in a way that creates a sense of strength. So if anyone just tries to tell you that this sense of overwhelm is because of your age or because of the economy or because of some personality issue, you want to be clear that there are much bigger forces at play than that. And as we start to understand them, what's going to happen out of this is we're going to start building cultural structures that provide the right kind of stability with a lot of flux. Now, a lot of where that's coming from is it's coming from evolutionary thinking, which Alfred North Whitehead was one of the big founders of. But this sense of living, and Buckminster Fuller, Teilhard de Chardin, other people like that, the sense of living in process and movement versus as static entities where we need to create places that we can rest in a solid way. So it's deep stuff. It's stuff really at the edge of philosophical thinking. Evolutionary biology is working on it. Evolutionary psychology is working on it. It's a lot of where those who are looking at culture in these deeper ways are looking at is how do we create a framework and a perspective that helps us actually get along with the world as we understand it now. So this is, it's just a fascinating look. And what meditation does help us do is it helps us basically let go and depersonalize all of this. And then you start to be open and you can start to see different interrelationships between things that you weren't expecting. You don't take things so personally. You don't assume that there's something wrong with you because you feel a certain way. You don't assume that you're the cause of something. And also you start to recognize cause and effect, that if you do things that create upset and cause suffering to other people, you will feel the effects. It's not rocket science, you know. And that's part of the thing we want to become more sensitive to, because if we want to start working in culture, you know, and I know all of you are very positively ambitious, you want to start working and intuiting these things. You want to keep your mind free in this way, so you can really start looking at the big changes that need to happen and then how that translates into our lives. So we'll meditate. Any questions? Thoughts? Interesting, right? The cell phone's the problem. The cell phone's the evil.
I guess in the right order, it would be like the television, the computer, the cell phone, right? So, but it goes a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot more than that.
A lot more than that, and different than that. Well, we will talk about all those things either next week, next time, or the week after, because that's also. But when you start to understand those things in this context, they also feel different. You go, oh, okay, I understand why that also impinges on me in the way it does. Yeah?
You mentioned that this whole, this idea of having an individual way of thinking is fascinating. I think that we have to push for this idea of everybody having their own individual way of thinking. It is fascinating and it's amazing, but it's also scary to those specific people who might look at it that way. Because at one point, like you stated, our justification for the way things happen was simply, it was the will of God. The reason we had monarchies was, I'm king and ruler and dictator, and that comes from the will of God. But then scientific revolution comes along, and individual revolutions come, and they separate the church from the government. And they bring about these ideas of, maybe we don't have to do it this way. Then people start to wonder, what is the reason we have... for example, a high infant mortality rate in this place and not in this place. So why we have this system of government that's collapsing here but not collapsing over there. And even though it's an amazing way of thinking, it scares a lot of people because now they have to develop those thoughts.
Right.
So I just thought when you said that it was fascinating, I also thought to myself that it's extremely scary for people to have to think like that.
Well, it's very scary because... individuals, it's, you know, look at the founding fathers, it's still true in our day and age, people don't think that deeply about life. So if you have equal vote to someone who really doesn't care what happens, doesn't think deeply about life, and doesn't have a sense of compassion and connectedness, you know, why do you want them deciding for you? But that's how we work. So this is it is a really big deal, and it's a big deal also with the, you know, all of what they're doing with genetics and science and technology, because people now have the power that even the great, you know, what they attributed to gods in Greek mythology, the gods didn't even have the kind of power that we have now in technology. And those, you know, lab technicians who are innovating, they're not necessarily that evolved on an ethical and moral level. So they're thinking about their breakthrough, their intelligence, their prizes, and just the love of discovery. But they're not thinking about the human result of some of the innovations, you know, some of the genetic capacities we have now to manipulate. They're good and they're bad. You know, we can discover grave birth defects when, you know, the fetus is just, you know, a few weeks old, and you know, and then the parents can do something about that rather than having a baby who has no, you know, who only has a, you know, a chance of a couple weeks survival and so much trauma. That's great. But there are a lot of things that it can be used for that aren't. And who, you know, are those people thinking about it that deeply? Not really, because of the separation of church and state and the separation between scientific materialism and religion. So the fact that those two stopped talking to each other also meant that many scientists stopped paying attention to the moral and ethical dimensions of things. Not everyone, of course. You know, and of course the nuclear bomb was a big deal, because that's when a lot of the scientists formed what was called the Union of Concerned Scientists, because, you know, Oppenheimer was devastated by what he discovered and what happened, and then, you know, that small cadre of very elite scientists realized that their creating things beyond. Yeah. Yeah.
Did you play psychology?
No, I didn't. I studied political science, educational theory, and regional development.
What's educational theory?
It's how kids learn. So different developmental systems. So what you learn it, you know, so that's what I studied. But I've read a lot of psychology over the years. So. Great. All right, so should we, we have, I don't know which clock is right. I think that one might be a little slow. We might have 1 minute, so
okay.
We might not.
I'm not quite sure. Can somebody check a phone?
We have 4 minutes. 49?
We have four.
Yeah, I think we do have 1 minute.
I think we have 1 minute, but, so I won't, yes. Oh, did you? Yeah, let's do a short minute. Everyone's coming downstairs, so it's going to be a really short. Let's do a short 15 seconds until the bell rings. Okay, thanks a lot. Have a nice Thanksgiving.